Make your coffee while I talk. There's really, we are casual here. But I am going to be using my very best of Americanisms to speak very fast so you can get as much in as possible. And reading quotes takes time, so I will send you all via Sarah all the different like little bits of quotes you may be interested in. So last time we discussed dress in the Bible, and this time we're looking at the Middle Ages, and then we'll look at modern times as quickly as possible. So the reason I study dress is because I think it informs us a lot about who we are, where we come from, and what was happening to us at the time. And the history of Jews in Europe is definitely told through dress really, really well. What we're wearing tells you a lot about how we're perceived by the world outside, because we didn't get to choose what we wore, which is already part of an issue where you're not allowed to choose what you wear. So I want to start with Jews in Spain. This is from the Catalonian Haggadah. And the way Jews present themselves as opposed to the way Jews are presented are very different. So the way we see ourselves, the way we want to be seen, rather than the way we are viewed, makes a huge difference. So the reason I'm showing you a Haggadah is because obviously a Haggadah is made for us, by us. We are asked, we commissioned it, right? Someone paid a lot of money to have the Haggadah made. They're obviously going to display themselves in their best way possible. So consider a portrait of a grandfather or grandmother in your home. They're going to be wearing their finery. They're not going to be wearing, you know, whatever it is that they wear to cook in. So this is a Haggadah. The couple that commissioned it drew themselves sitting at their Seder table with a server. Check out the perspective here. The server is not another person. They're a smaller person, which is, this is 13th century perspective at its best. And the woman's wearing a gold thing on her head. She's wearing gold buttons. And these are all picked out in gold, specifically so you could see the wealth. In 1267, a preacher in Provence says, "Don't dress like the Jews." And he meant in this ornate, wealthy style. So again, this is the way Jews perceive themselves, the way they're perceived by others. In 1136 is the first time Jews are expelled from France. The reason we don't know about the expulsion from France, vis-a-vis the expulsion from, say, England or Spain, is because in France, the expulsions happen often, and they're allowed back in. They're expelled and allowed back in easily. Why are they expelled? Because the king owes them money. So the king says, "I don't want to pay you. You're out." And then a few years later, come back in, they loan the king money again, and when the king doesn't want to pay, they're expelled again. And this happens multiple times in France. So this image is done around the time the Jews are expelled, but these symbols here are added on later because they want to show the king pointing, you know, this is a get out of here sign. He's showing them where to go. And then later on, in order to differentiate these people, these symbols are added. So we'll get to the symbols momentarily, but this is added afterwards. In 1215, the Fourth Lateran Council meets. And the Fourth Lateran Council issues a whole bunch of canons, laws. Canon number 68 is devoted fully to the Jews. And it says as follows. Daniel, you'll read, since I know your name and I know who to call on. I could have. It's true. But I don't want to pick on it.
In some provinces, a difference in dress distinguishes the Jews or Saracens from the Christians. But in certain others, such a confusion has grown up that they cannot be distinguished by any difference. Thus, happens at times that through error, Christians have relations with the women Jews or Saracens, and Jews and Saracens with Christian women. Therefore, that they may not, under pretext of error of this sort, excuse themselves in the future for the excesses of such prohibited intercourse, we decree that such Jews and Saracens of both sexes in every...
Give it away.
Christian province, at all times shall be marked off in the eyes of the public from other peoples through their character of their dress, particularly since it may be read in the writings of Moses, Numbers 15, 37 to 41, that this very law has been enjoined upon them.
Excellent. So, the Pope issues a decree. What's he concerned about?
Mixed dancing.
Mixed dancing. Thank you, Daniel, says the rabbi. He's concerned, but check out the language that women is an issue here. Just pointing it out, the women are the issue, that they're inadvertently going to have relations with these Jewish or Saracen women. What are Saracens?
Arabs.
How many Arabs are there in Europe at the time?
Seven.
Someone said seven, probably. There is no minority in Europe aside from one, Jews. We're the only minority. They're aware of them, but they are not actually living in Europe. So this is a law dictated against the Jews of Europe. They're going to have to wear a distinguishing mark because what's the issue? We look just like them. And this is a problem because we need to know who the enemy is. So we need to make sure that we can point out the enemy. So this is, what's the crime? Why are we the enemy? This is in a cathedral in Northumberland. The hat is called a Jewish hat. So before the Jews had a symbol, they supposedly were picked out by having a hat that was uniquely Jewish. You see the symbol across all of Europe until around the 13th century. And the Jew is showing, nailing Jesus to the cross. And this image you could find across Europe, especially in England. So what's the crime? Jews killed Jesus. It's a Jew. He is in the process of nailing Jesus to the cross. That is his crime, and therefore we need to pick him out. Was it so in Muslim lands? So this is from Spain, 13th century, and it is a Muslim and a Jew playing chess, right? They're together in the same space. They're of the same height. Remember I showed you the other one where a servant is smaller. These people are of the same height, but they're dressed differently. So what's the deal there? The Muslim world, until the 13th into the 14th century, is actually really multicultural. To the point that when the Jews are kicked out of Spain, it's the Ottoman Empire that welcomes them. They had a Christian as well as Zoroastrian minority. They had no problem with a Jewish minority. They still belonged in their place. The Arab world was all about hierarchy, and Jews could exist in that hierarchy. In the Christian world, Jews didn't actually exist in any hierarchy. We were parallel to it. In the Muslim world, we were part of that hierarchy, but we still had to dress different. And that distinction remained as these are the Jews. On the other hand, Muslims would marry Jewish women, not the other way around. They would eat at each other's homes, and Jews were allowed into all professions, i.e. the Rambam, who is in both Spain and then in Egypt, a physician for the Sultan. Like, this is what he's doing, we know of others. So in the Muslim world, it's not quite as clear-cut as it is in the Christian world.
Okay, was that an Ottoman picture then?
So it's from Spain, 13th century, so it's from Al-Andalus, which is the part of Spain that actually gets conquered by the Spanish latest. So we have still Muslim images coming out of Spain. And if you go there even today, you still see in Toledo a lot of architecture that looks Muslim and Islamic because they were there for so long. They were there for about seven centuries. And it's only when Ferdinand and Isabella actually conquer all of Spain and united it becomes Christian. We're going to have a bagel break, Julian, and then a bagel break.
How multicultural were they around
So that's a great question. So in 1160, the Al-Andalus, which is a militant branch of Muslims come in and invade Spain, and they actually force Jews to convert to Islam. This is before any Jew is forced to convert to Christianity. And the Rambam's family escapes to Morocco, and then the Al-Andalus sect gets to Morocco, and he has to escape Morocco. He goes to Israel, and from Israel, he goes to Egypt, where he finally settles. So not an easy life. Bagels. And then I give you 5 minutes for the bagels, and then sit back down. Is the Pope so determined to point out who the Jews were? Not just because they committed a crime, but he's thinking forward. He really believes that there's a positive reason to do this. The reason is that the Pope believes that the second coming of Jesus is going to happen in the year 1284. And he's going to be responsible for converting all the Muslims to Christianity in order that the second coming can happen. But there are no Muslims in Europe, so the Jews are seen as a fifth column, and therefore they need to be converted as well. But how are we going to convert them if we can't tell who they are? So we're going to find a way to distinguish them from other people. So the Pope has got a plan. And the plan is we're going to have to identify the Jews, not just for the crimes they committed in the past, but in order to speed up the second coming of Jesus. I.e., Jesus does not come a second time, but the law remains. 1284 comes and goes. The Pope goes on a fifth crusade, which is not successful. And the crusades end. But this hate and anti-Semitism, or anti... By the way, the word anti-Semitism was only coined in 1879 by a German journalist. Before that, it's anti-Jewish. There is no such thing as Semitism, therefore there can't be anti-Semitism. So for those of you who see it as two words or one word is usually the one we feel more comfortable with, because otherwise we're saying Semitism is a word. Taking us to, we're going to do a quick roundup of Europe and the way, because the Pope says they need to wear a symbol, he doesn't identify what that symbol needs to look like. Edward III introduces the symbol to England. England is one of the first countries to adopt it. So it is issued in 1215, 1225. Remember, this is like, takes time for news to travel in Middle Ages Europe. Edward III says all Jews over the age of 7 need to wear a symbol that identifies them and needs to be 3 fingers in width and 4 fingers in length, and it needs to look like tablets. So no prizes for guessing what's going on here. And Jews are forced to wear it. It's originally white. It's then reinforced as yellow, yellow being a pejorative color. Yellow is the color of sin. And therefore, you'll see Jews often in yellow. By the way, I love wearing yellow. I don't know why yellow got such a bad rep, but it did. Which takes us to France. In France, the symbol keeps on changing. This is from the Encyclopedia Judaica, 1903. It is not of the time. This is not Middle Ages, but you can see the symbol in terms of there's a circle with a line across it, there's a heart, and there is the Jewish hat. You can't see him, but the guy here at the end, you can kind of see the top of his hat. And what you're seeing are these symbols. So the reason, there's the hat. So the symbol changes because France isn't actually a fully unified country, so each province decides on a different way to do the symbol. Another one from France, you can see the symbol. What's going on here? This is a picture of Mary with Jesus, John the Baptist, and I forgot the third, which is fine because I'm a Robinson. I don't need to know who the third person is. But the way we present Jews now in paintings is with the symbol, not doing anything bad, but we're presenting a Jew coming up to Mary, and you need the symbol to now identify a Jew. And the reason this symbol is as it is in France is because it's supposed to show the host. The host is, yes?
Sorry, only one is wearing the symbol, but surely Christian theology, whatever, how everyone would be judged. He was the king of the Jews.
It's true. I do not know why the other one is not wearing the symbol. I'm presenting it as an example.
Okay.
So I don't know the story, and again, I excuse myself from not knowing Christian theology very well, though I do know more than many of the priests that Daniel and I do interfaith dialogue with, which is what I learned at Stern, which is a fully all-women's Orthodox university in New York. I still know more Christian theology than many of our colleagues of the Anglican Church. So, no, I do not know why he isn't. I don't actually know the scene exactly. But why the circle in France of this shape as opposed to the tablets in England? The Jews are said to desecrate the host. The host is when you hear the body and the blood of Jesus. And the reason I choose not to use the word Christ is because Christ is the Greek word for the Messiah. And we don't believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and therefore I choose not to use it. That's why there are people who say Xmas as opposed to Christmas. So the reason they say that this is the reenactment of Jesus is in his body, this wafer that is oval in shape, and the Jews were said to stomp it, stab it, desecrate it in every way possible. What they're doing is reenacting the murder of Jesus. And therefore, Jews were said to desecrate the body of Jesus, and therefore they have to wear it on their clothing. In Venice, they choose a hat, so you have a beautifully dressed woman. She's even got a headdress on, and then she has a piece of cloth, this shmata basically, on her head to identify her as a Jew. Women suffered more than men. In Rome, Jewish women are made to wear red petticoats, and then later on, they're made to wear white veils with blue stripes. The only other women in Rome who had to wear red petticoats and white veils with blue stripes are prostitutes. So either she's a Jew or she's a prostitute. And obviously, those two could get confused, and women were constantly being harassed because of it. Which brings us to Spain. So you can't really see it, but in the corner, there is a man holding a cross, and you have two Jews, a woman and a man, and they have the symbol. They're leading Jesus or someone carrying a cross to their crucifixion. So, by the way, in Jerusalem, you could do, if you chose, the Via della Rosa, which Christian pilgrims do today. They pick up a cross in the Gardens of Gethsemane, and they walk the Via della Rosa to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and they've carried this cross the whole way through. They're reenacting Jesus going to the cross, who was said to be paraded there by the Jews. So this is a reenactment of that, putting Jews squarely in the place where they're the ones who did this. Germany. So this is Frankfurt, and the year is 1700. And here we see a whole bunch of ways of identifying Jews. Germany is one of the last countries to adopt the symbol because prior to that, you were able to distinguish a Jew from a non-Jew. What you have is the Jews wearing distinguishing garb until around 1430, at which point they start looking like everyone else and they need to institute the symbol. Germany, like France and Italy, is a whole bunch of principalities which are only unified in the mid-1800s. So you have Frankfurt, and this Jewish lady has what's called a Shabbos mantle, mantle being coat. Shabbos mantle is only opened on the left side. Why? Shabbos, left side, because you can't really use your right hand on Shabbos to do any work. So you can only really access it through your left side. She's wearing the kerchief, and she's holding a goose. Why?
Frogba.
Frogba, actually. But you've been here before, Daniel. You're not allowed to answer the questions.
Did you mean that they were forced to put them there?
No. This is like they self-imposed would put on what's called the Shabbos mantle, which they really could only, the opening was on the left so that they were reminded not to use their right hand on Shabbos. So she's wearing Shabbos mantle, he's just wearing a cloak, and there's a reason he's wearing a weekday cloak and not a Shabbos one, and she's holding a goose. Jews had very little land, so they couldn't really have a cow. But what they had was geese, and they became the cultivators of geese and foie gras because they could do that with very limited space. And Jews, so if you see any chillent recipes from the Middle Ages, the meat was goose, and the fat was goose fat. That's where schmaltz came from. They didn't have chickens. They had geese, and they were known for their geese. The man is holding a bag of money, right? Because that goes hand in hand. And on the other hand, he's holding garlic. Jews were known to cook with onion and garlic more than any other culture, and said to smell of it as well. But he's wearing a weekday cloak because he's holding money. It's a really interesting image. All right.
Is that a Jewish painting or not?
No, it's not. Again, Jews would not present themselves that way.
Okay.
We would never choose to put that symbol because it is humiliating. It's humiliating to be pointed out in that way. I would never choose that for myself. This is not a mark of pride in any way, and I'll show you why in a moment.
Exactly.
There's nothing right about this.
Okay.
They're trying somehow to choose every single pejorative image of a Jew and put it into one image. 1551, the king of Austria, whose name escapes me at the moment, sees that the Jews aren't actually wearing the symbol. He reissues the order and puts the example of the badge on the order. This is 1551. This is already into past the Renaissance. So this continues, and in the order it says if Jews are in any of his towns for more than a month, they need to wear the symbol. In Spain, which is one of the hardest things I find, in the cathedral in Barcelona, this is an image of Jewish women, because unlike Jewish men who are allowed to wear it on their breasts and on their back, Jewish women had to wear the symbol on their foreheads. So it's derogatory in every way possible. And that's what I want to show you. Where does it lead? And the Nazis reenact this. They didn't, you know, make it up out of nowhere. Look at the bride. Who holds their flowers that way? She's covering the star. Because no one, I mean it, no one has ever held their flowers up here. That's just not what you're going to do. And she's just doing it because she's humiliated that on her wedding day, she's made to put a Jewish star on her dress. This is Amsterdam, 1942. Checking time. Okay, very, very quickly. This is a painting that today exists in the Santa Maria de Victoria Church in Mantua. This is Daniel Nostra and his wife and his son, and they have a very thin circle around them. What's the story here? Daniel Nostra buys a house in Mantua in the main piazza, and there's a fresco of Jesus on the cross on the outside of his house. He asks permission from the Marquis to paint over the fresco. It is granted, and he paints over it. The townspeople get very upset and start throwing rocks at his house and humiliating him. And there's an anti-Semitic riot because he paints over the fresco, which he got permission to do. He then writes to the Marquis again and says, can it stop? The Marquis is out at war, so the Marquis's mistress writes back and says, obviously this has to stop. We gave you permission, and therefore we won't allow it. The Marquis comes back from the war, and he loses said war, and he says it's all Daniel de Nostra's fault because he painted over the painting of Jesus at the cross that was in the town piazza. And in retribution, he's going to not only have to knock down his house, we're going to build a church where his house is, and he's going to give us the money to paint a spectacular painting. This painting, with the Marquis on his knees, bowing down to Mary, hangs at the Louvre today. The painting that hangs in the church, which was built over Daniele Nostra's house, is this one. It's called The Jews' Mary. So they painted Daniele his wife, his son, and his daughter-in-law beneath the painting. And it says in Italian, which again, I'll send you the quote because I'm trying to do this fast, that the chutzpah of the Jews has been terminated. Basically, they dared to paint over and we made them pay for it. So the symbol continues and continues. I want to bring you into modern day, just so you can see the entirety of it. I'm going to escape and we're going to open the next one. And we're going to do the next slideshow in 15 minutes. Let's see how we do this. There we go. Okay. This is actually going to be much more upbeat, I promise. In 1881, there's the start of the pogroms in Europe, and 2.5 million Jews leave Eastern Europe. 2 million of them arrive in America, and 150,000 come to England. So that's a huge number of Jews. By the way, had the 2 million Jews who arrived in America stayed Jewish, there would not be a population of 5 million Jews today. It'd be more like 20 million. Because do the maths, it's just not, so many Jews fell off the grid at some point. But what you see is this mass immigration. And we've been led to believe, and this is a mistake, that somehow Jews had an advantage coming into this that other people didn't. It's just not true. So I want to dispel that. Jews were so literate. Jews had all this advantage coming in. We didn't have anything more or less than other people. So I want to highlight this guy. This is Burton. I'm not British, and therefore I did not know of Burton's. Burton Montague. Thank you, Daniel. So his name is Moshe David Ozinski. Comes to England in 1900. He's a Lithuanian immigrant, and he arrives and opens up a tailoring shop in Chesterfield in 1903. By 1939, there's 595 shops across Britain, and he makes a quarter of all the uniforms in World War II. And then when soldiers are demobbed, it's Montague Burton who actually supplies them with a suit, which the British Army gave them in order to go and find a job after they were demobbed. So they do very, very well for themselves. Montague Burton still exists today, only online, but he is Sir Montague Maurice Burton, so he changes from Moshe David Ozinski to Montague Maurice Burton, and he passes away in 1952, but this is someone who did well. Did he have any advantage over any other group? And the answer is going to be no, but we'll get there. But this incredible wealth that the Jewish community amasses, today the Jewish community, both in the UK and in America, are in the top 10% economically. But that wasn't our trajectory. When we talk about the shtetl, when we talk about Eastern Europe, Jews are amongst the poorest. So this is not who we were ever until the 20th century. This is a whole new stratosphere we're in. We're in fact incredibly poor for most of history. So this is a whole new world, and it's actually that mass immigration of what's happening in the world that allows this to happen. When Jews come to America in 1897, there's a census taken, and that census tells us about the literacy of Jews. Jews are no more literate than anyone else. So that idea, Jews are literate. Firstly, they only tested the literacy of men in 1897, so I can't speak about the women, but Jews were said to be more literate than Poles, Lithuanians, Belarusians, and Southern Italians, but less literate than British, Scandinavian, or German immigrants to America. So they're somewhere in the middle. David Olinsky, yes?
But in which languages will they just be interested?
Any language. Only 1/3 of Jewish men could read Yiddish. This is a very low number. We have this image of every Jewish child goes to cheder and is, you know, licking the honey off the aleph beis. That is not the truth. There is a select few who do. When we think about people sitting and learning all day, that's a modern phenomenon. This is not the reality of the shtetl. And we deceive ourselves when we think that everyone in the shtetl was learning. They weren't. They were incredibly poor. The idea of Jews being professionals, this is incredibly new. This is an incredibly modern phenomenon, which only happens once we emigrate. And that's why clothing is so important, because all of a sudden, things that we assumed become real. So only a third of Jewish men could read in any language. And that's why they're saying, what's the literacy of Poles, Southern Italians? They're testing them in their own languages. And the test is done on Ellis Island. So they don't expect these people to be able to read English. English is a whole new language to them. So what you have is these people coming to this Golden Medina. It isn't. But why clothing? And clothing is really important because it's the easiest place to enter. You don't need very much to be into Shabbos, right? I've asked this question when people are far older than you, especially in the UK. I ask how many of your families came between 1881 and 1914, and the majority of the room raises its hand, and I ask how many were in the Shmata trade, and the same amount of people raise their hand. Of that 150,000 Jews who come between 1881 and 1914 to England, 80% are employed by the Shmata trade. The other 20% are serving that 80% as butchers and bakers and everything that then serves that community. That was the only, it's not the prime, it's the only thing Jews are doing because it's easy entry. You can, in your attic, I have a picture. We'll get there 1 second. We're going to skip. There we go. This is a warehouse in Stepney owned by the Schneider family. And I think the year is around 1910, I believe. And these people don't have anything. They have so little, but they're all sewn buttons or they're sewn pockets. And then it's going to someone else who's then putting it together. There are cutters. By the way, cutters are the best job to have. It's the most important, it's the highest paid, and only men could be cutters, not women. Women could do everything else. They just couldn't be cutters because once you cut fabric, you're done, right? And you have to cut it precisely. So it's the most risky job there is. But what do the Jews have that the non-Jews don't? They're all related to each other. They all know each other. So they come off the boat and says, Maish, David is working there, we'll hire him too. And these become family affairs. And everyone's related to each other, or everyone came from the same village. They're all working together, they support each other. The first thing the Jews do is build a chevra kadisha, which isn't just for people who have died, it's also for people who are well. So they're supporting each other through this, which that community bonding is what the Jews have, not literacy. And it's the community that works together that allows them to succeed, but they don't need very much. I think it's 10 pence that allows them to start any sort of manufacturing of fabric in any way. By 1910, 10 to 20% of all Jews in England own their own business. By 1940, it's 40 to 45% of all Jews own their own business. This is an incredible number. Why can Jews do this? Because they've always been self-employed. Jews couldn't get jobs anywhere in Europe. They always had to make their own living. Entrepreneurial skills is what they come with. This is what differentiates them. They have a community and they have an entrepreneurial spirit because they've always had to have one. So their advantage is coming from their disadvantage, which is incredible. It's sad, but it also allows them to succeed. What they then do, which is why we can sit in a suburb in London 100 years later, is that they invest that money in their grandchildren, their children, their grandchildren, and they send them to professional education. How many Jews are still in the Shmata trade in the East End? Mr. Epstein, who lives on Green Lane, he still has his shop, right? What's his first name? Leo Epstein, still has his shop. That's it. His son is called Daniel Epstein. He's married to Beth, not Ilana, but we did get a lot of mazel tovs. They live next door to my parents. My father was wished a mazel tov when I supposedly had a baby. My father's like, she's not married yet, but okay. So he's the only one Jewish shop left in Shmatas in the East End, because everyone took their money, invested in their children. Their children became doctors and lawyers and accountants, and the entire professionalism of the community came up. It was decided as a community that's what they do. Their real break was luck, and that's all it was. Before 1900, women's fashion always stayed the same. It changed very slowly, and then what you see is this incredible transformation. Every year, fashion changed. The Jews got on board with that, and they're like, we are going to monopolize it, and we're going to push fashion. So fashion wasn't being pushed by the people themselves. It was being pushed by manufacturing. There was a new skirt, a new length, a new cut, a new bias, and every time the Jews would push a new thing forward and make it happen, which brings us to 1960. Between 1914 and 1954, England did not open its doors to immigrants. There was a trickle of people coming into the UK, which made it possible for this upward mobility of the Jews who had been in the Shmata trade. What happened prior to this is any new immigrant society would push in underneath the previous immigrant society and undercut them. We're willing to work harder for less. Every immigrant society did that, but when England shut its doors in 1914, there was no immigrant population to come after the Jews, so the Jews were able to raise their prices and raise the entire community because there was no community to undercut them. It's only in the 1960s when the Bangladeshi community comes in that Jews all of a sudden are actually, it's actually the Windrush generation plus the Bangladeshi community that pushes the Jews out of Shmatas and firmly into professional trades because they do undercut them. But by then, the Jews have already had three generations in the UK and therefore are more than comfortable leaving it. But the Jews who remain in the Shmata trade become the designers and the retailers, no longer the wholesalers of fashion, therefore earning a lot more money. Carnaby Street in the 1960s, when fashion, British fashion, is the rage of the world, is controlled by Jews. So you have John Stevens, Cecil G., and Mr. Fish, all Jewish. And then you have Lady Jane, Lord John, and what was Take Six, again, all Jewish. These become fashion labels of the 60s, where all of a sudden Jews have taken the Shmatas all the way to the very end. And if I was talking about American fashion, I would introduce you to Ralph Lauren and Dalma Karen, who take it even further. So this keeps on going. So we go from a Jewish population that's marginalized by its clothing to a Jewish population that actually sees its current success because of clothing. Clothing is so important. We wear it every day. We judge each other by what we wear. To dismiss it, you dismiss it at your own peril, because people are telling you who they are by what they're wearing. And I think we have to consider what people wear a lot more than we currently do, because we all send messages out to the world with what we wear. I ask students often, now that you could choose how you dress, no one's telling you how to dress. How do you want to dress? Do you want to dress like a Jew, or do you want to dress like everyone else? And it's a good question to ask. I'll leave you with a story. At the height of anti-Semitism, we live in central London, and we had a lot of protests, and Daniel, myself, and our son Jacob were walking to the Ajax March in November of 2023, and I made Daniel and Jacob wear a big baseball cap, and I made Jacob, who wears his seats out, tuck them into his trousers. And as we're walking down, from home, through Hyde Park, through St. James's Park, past Buckingham Palace, there's a family of Hasidic Jews in front of us. And he's got his payas out. She's, bedecked in her glory. And Daniel and Jacob both look at me and they're like, baseball cap? Like, what's the point? When you get to choose how you dress, how would you choose to dress? Thank you all so much. That was a lot. Wow, I didn't have 2 minutes to spare. Yes, of course.
When did the mindset change between having to wear certain clothes and then certainly in sort of Eastern Europe, because it was something of looking so different, like you were saying, with the distinctive.
So that's a whole different history. The way Hasidut sees clothing, they see those as not religious symbols, but a religious imperative. It's part of keeping to Judaism, the way some women see tzniut as being halachically command, like that's the way they see their clothing.
Shnayim are no more tzniut than other hats, but they're.
It's not tzniut. They see it as a halachic imperative. Like I'm going to dress this way, and not dressing this way means that I'm abandoning part of my culture, and that's a problem.
But what that way is.
So in the 16th century, Polish nobility dressed in a certain way. Jews were not allowed to dress in that way. The minute it was allowed, the Jews saw it as I'm going to dress in the highest way possible for Hashem, who is my king, and not a Polish king. And that's why they adapted that specific dress. So shtreimels, bekeshes, the hoichen and the zochen are all part of what Polish nobility wore in the 16th century, and Hasidic Jews adapted it to their own purposes. Every child of Hasidut has a different way of wearing it.
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, thank you all, and have a wonderful week ahead.